Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Off the Record. I'm your host, Jordan Runtog. Thanks so much for listening. Our latest chapter examines David Bowie at the dawn of the 70s. It was the decade he'd grow to dominate, but the beginning was not very auspicious. David had experienced the first taste of fame with Space Oddity, but as he'd later sing, the taste was not so sweet. The song came and went, and David was in danger of being labeled that most sorry of artists, the one-hit wonder. It was a transitional time for David, as he sought to solidify his look and his sound. He morphed from the space folk hippie of Space Oddity, to the godfather of glam behind The Man Who Sold the World, and finally the androgynous tunesmith who'd release his breakthrough, the wonderfully eccentric Hunky Dory. The album would open with the song Changes. Destined to become one of his signature tunes, it was something of a personal anthem at the time. David faced changes in management, changes in homes, changes in musicians, and in his personal style. The changes were mostly good ones and set him up for the success that was just around the corner. The episode opens with perhaps the most significant moment of this exciting period, his first trip to the United States. Bowie touched down at Dulles International Airport in Washington, D.C. on January 23, 1971. This was a major occasion for him. He'd been America mad as a teen. The moment was a triumph, until he was detained by custom officials for his feminine clothes. He received a warmer welcome from Ron Oberman, his press agent sent to greet him by his label, Mercury Records. This wasn't just strictly business. Ron was joined by his entire family, his mom, his dad, and his younger brother, music journalist Michael Oberman. David had wanted to spend his first night in the States with a typical American family. And that's exactly what he got. The future starman crash-landed at the Obermans' suburban home in Silver Springs, Maryland, where he was welcomed like one of their own. They all piled into the car, and the senior Obermans treated their newly enlarged family to dinner at a local steakhouse. The Obermans' hospitality foreshadowed the warm embrace Bowie would receive from America throughout his career. His first night in the United States has gone down in Bowie lore as an important early step in his journey to global superstardom. The trip is the plot of a new film, Stardust, a movie that's been deemed controversial for its liberal reinterpretation of historical events. Ron Oberman, an instrumental force in Bowie's early career, sadly died in 2019, but his brother Michael recounted the famous visit in his new book, Fast Forward, Play, and Rewind. One part memoir, the book also collects his interviews with over 100 rock legends, ranging from Janis Joplin and James Brown to the Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, Leon Russell, Emmett Rhodes, Little Feat, and of course, David. I was lucky enough to speak with Michael about his remarkable career as a music journalist and that special night with David Bowie in his parents' living room back in 1971. Well, oh man, I have so many things I want to ask you. I guess before I ask you about Bowie's first night in America, I wanted to ask you about the very first time you spoke to him a few years earlier in 1969.
Well, my brother had sent me a copy of Space Oddity, and I had also been subscribing to New Musical Express and Melody Maker because as a writer for a major newspaper, I wanted to know what was going on with the British music scene. And the, of course, I had subscriptions to American journals too, like Billboard and eventually Rolling Stone. The interview with David in 69 was very brief. I asked him a couple of questions and it was done, and I wrote my piece. Obviously, fast forwarding to 71, it was a totally different story. You know, at the time of Space Oddity, that's all I knew about Bowie. He was not a household name in the United States in 1969. And in fact, in 71, he was far from a household name because people had already forgotten Space Oddity. It was a brief introduction, a hello, arranged by my brother, since my brother worked for Mercury Records. And that was it.
And around this time, and this is all in your incredible book, Fast Forward, Play, and Rewind, you interviewed hundreds of rock legends. I mean, my favorite is this picture of you at the Watergate Hotel with James Brown. It's just, it's unbelievable. I mean, who were some highlights from you for that era?
My favorite interviews, really, maybe Joni Mitchell, because she wasn't granting interviews at that time, and I got one with her. Jim Morrison backstage at the Spectrum Theater in Philadelphia.
Wow.
There was my Janis Joplin interview. It was Janis Joplin headlining with the Jeff Beck Group opening for her. And at the time, the Jeff Beck Group, the lead singer was Rod Stewart. The bass player was Ron Wood. Keyboard player was Nicky Hopkins. And the gig was at the Alexandria, Virginia roller rink. This was before there were really concert halls. So I interviewed Jeff Beck in the dressing room, and Janice's driver comes up to me and says she would like to do the interview at her hotel. There were two shows, one at 4 p.m. and one at 8 p.m. And he would drive me to the hotel and bring me back to my car. So I go there, and she's got a suite. So there's a bedroom and a living room, and I'm sitting on the couch waiting for her to come in. And on the coffee table in front of me is a bong and a bottle of Southern Comfort. And Janice comes in.
Her favorite.
And she's wearing a low-cut kind of Mexican peasant blouse, and she had just done a great show. She's kind of sweaty. And she leaned over to grab the bottle of Southern Comfort while saying to me, "Would you like a drink?" And I said, "No, not while I'm working." And when she leaned over, one breast came out of her blouse, totally. And it stayed out for the entire interview. Now, I'm a 20-year-old guy trying to interview Janis Joplin, and I'm trying to look her in the eyes. So, people ask me, what do I remember? I certainly remember her breast. And there are moments like that. Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers. Midnight till 6 a.m. show at the Fillmore East. I set up an interview with Jerry Garcia for after the show, which means 6:30 in the morning at the hotel. And I'm in a room, in a hotel room with Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, one of their managers, John McIntyre, and a roadie. And once again, there's a coffee table, but on this coffee table, there's a gallon jug of like cheap wine, Gallo wine.
Pigpen must have been nearby.
And I wanted to break the ice somehow, and I was kind of an amateur magician back then, so I had crumpled up in my hand a ball of something called flash paper. And they passed a joint around to me, and I made it a habit not to smoke or drink when I was doing an interview. And when they passed me the joint, I dropped the ash into my hand, and a ball of flame shot out of my hand from the flash paper. Jerry Garcia grabbed the jug of wine and doused my hand with wine, thinking it was on fire. And of course, they were tripping. And what happens, the interview turns into me explaining flash paper and flash pots. And soon after that, the Grateful Dead began using flash pots on stage. So I think about moments and, you know, was it a coincidence that they learned about flash paper from me, or was it Providence? You know, so obviously having David Bowie spend the day with me and my parents and my brother was great. But if you could put yourself in my shoes for a minute, this was my job. But not only was it my job, I was the same age as most of these artists. So there was a simpatico that was there already. I had long hair, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was such a heady time for me because at a young age, here I was interviewing the cream of the crop of the music industry. And what you see in my book is, I think about 110 or 115 interviews of the 300 that were published of the 500 that I did, because there were a lot of interviews that I did that I just never ran. The interviews weren't good. The group was too stoned, too drunk, et cetera. And then, you know, I'll go to an oddball interview, the legendary Stardust Cowboy. How many people in the United States had interviewed the legendary Stardust Cowboy when Paralyzed came out? Not many.
I imagine not many.
No. And then to have that connection later on with the legendary Stardust Cowboy and David Bowie is, you know, just still blows my mind.
Oh, it is incredible. I mean, I guess taking us up to 1971, tell me about going to the airport to meet him. I mean, this was the whole family, your mom, dad, you, Ron. I mean, I picture like a Cooler Griswolds just kind of like showing up at the airport. It's amazing.
Well, you know, the nice thing is my brother had hung with Bowie in London in 1969. And then over the 2 year period between 69 and 71, my brother dealt with Bowie and his management company quite a bit. So it was old home week for him. For me, it was really, because my brother had flown in from Chicago, for me, it was driving my parents out to Dulles, because as much as it was interesting for them to meet David Bowie, they wanted to see their son who had been living in Chicago and working for a record company. So we all get there, and we were probably expecting him to come out of customs about 45 minutes before he actually did. I think they probably held him up a little bit just because of the way he looked, the way he was dressed, et cetera. Which, you know, look, my brother and I had long hair. David Bowie had long hair. David, when he arrived at the airport, was in a calf length kind of flared coat that looked like a dress. And, you know, this was 1971 at Dulles Airport in Virginia, and I guess they were having some fun with him in customs.
Yeah, I mean, Nixon's America, I can't imagine taking kindly to a man in a dress arriving on their shores. That makes a lot of sense, I guess, for the time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, this morning when I did my radio interview in London, we talked about those times, because we had a war in Vietnam going on, and music played a big part in the anti-war movement. David Bowie's music did not play a big part in it, but what was going on at that time, you know, to take you to a day in time, the May Day demonstrations, and I helped organize the music for that in Washington, D.C., saw the largest mass arrest in U.S. history. 12,000 peaceful protesters handcuffed in zip tie handcuffs and taken to RFK Stadium as a holding cell. And
wow, this was in May 71?
1971. Yeah. Still holds a record. And you know, when, you know, I hate to get current, but January 6th at the Capitol, violent protesters, hardly any of them were arrested. They all should have been put in zip ties. And yet in 71, there were probably 70 to 80,000 people there for the music and the May Day anti-war protests. And 12,000 arrested. It was amazing. Bowie arrived at a seminal time in United States history. And he didn't fit in musically. The Man Who Sold the World First of all, let me say something about Mercury Records. God bless my brother who passed away. He did the best job he could for Mercury promoting acts. But Mercury, there's a reason why Graham Parker sang the song Mercury Poison. And part of it was Mercury didn't know how to promote LPs. They promoted a lot of 45s at the time. You're talking about Keith with 98.6. You're talking about the Left Bank, Pretty Ballerina. But album groups were not, you know, it was Mercury Poisoning. So they didn't know what to do with Bowie. The Man Who Sold the World was too dark of an album for them. But my brother believed in them. And the whole idea, the movie Stardust comes out, okay, and they have a disclaimer at the beginning of it that, you know, it's a lot of fiction. Well, it is mostly fiction. There are a few facts in there. In the movie, they make you seem to think that Bowie was surprised when he got to the United States that he couldn't perform. But he knew that before he came over. He didn't have a work visa at the time. In order for a British group to play paying gigs in the United States, an American group had to play paying gigs in Great Britain. Okay, so there was a tit for tat, there was a trade-off. I think the British invasion of groups earlier had caused that ruling to happen because a lot of British groups were doing concerts here and kind of knocking Americans off the stage. So David was not surprised. And My parents took him in like he was one of their children. I mean, the funny thing is the actress who plays my mother. Have you seen the film Stardust?
I haven't yet, no.
I really suggest you watching it on video on demand. It's really a dreadful movie. So,
ringing endorsement.
I think, you know, well, first of all, they have Marc Maron, who was 56 years old, playing my brother, who was 27 at the time that Bowie arrived. They have Marc Maron dropping the F-bomb in almost every scene, and my brother never cursed in his life. They have my mother say to David Bowie at the airport, "David, wait until you try my Kasha Varnishkas." Well, my mother never made a Jewish dish in her life. Then there's a scene in my parents' house where supposedly we were having dinner in the dining room with a younger brother and sister that I, to this day, don't know that they ever existed. But in the film, they do. And we didn't have dinner in the dining room. We went to a place called Emerson's Restaurant. But in that scene in the dining room, the actor who plays me, David, even acknowledges, "Hey, Michael. The actor who plays me says to David, are you a novelty act?" Now,
oh my gosh.
How embarrassing for me. My brother, unfortunately, you know, he had dementia the last years of his life. He didn't even know this movie was being made. But I had offered Salon Pictures 6 months before the filming started to give them background on that 71 trip. And the Paul Van Carter, the producer of the film, said, "I will put Gabriel Range, the director, in touch with you." Well, months went by. I get a call, British accent. "Oh, Michael, yes. Gabriel Range here, the director of Stardust. Oh, Gabriel, great. I guess you want to talk to me about my brother and what happened on that trip." He said, "Oh, well, we just finished shooting the film, 18 days in Hamilton, Canada." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, I know Marc Maron plays my brother, which I think is a big mistake, but can you tell me a little bit about the film?" And he says, "Well, it's about the road trip that David and your brother took across the United States in your brother's beat-up old station wagon." Well, that road trip never happened. It never occurred. So, you know, here I am. And then I on November 25th, when the film went on video on demand in the States, and it didn't go on video on demand in Great Britain until last week, which is why I've been getting all these calls from England. I watched it on November 25th, and I sat here with my partner, Mary Jane, watching the film and saying, "Oh, my God, you knew my mother. That's not my mother. You know me. And it really, you know, it skips a lot of important moments.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
I've had some family members and friends that have shown around on their first trip to the States, and it's always fun for me to see what they zero in on as being uniquely American and special to them. I remember I had some family from Italy come, and they were totally taken by chocolate chip cookies for some reason. I was wondering how David reacted to America for those first hours here. Was there anything he picked up on that was really unique and special to him about the United States?
Well, the strange thing is you would think that here David Bowie has arrived in the U.S. for the first time, and his wish that he told my brother was that he spend his first day with an American family. So it was really him asking us more questions than us asking him. He wanted to know about my father's work. He wanted to know about my writing. And when we went to the restaurant, we talked about film. We talked about writing. He discussed mime a little bit, and I tried to be really nice because mime is probably my least favorite art form in the world.
You're not alone in that.
And when I was on the student union board at the University of Maryland, one of the people that we booked was Marcel Marceau.
Wow.
And yeah, so it was almost like it wasn't somebody from London. It was just somebody who was from another city in America who wanted to talk about what we were doing. I had no idea at that point, but because I was going to be doing a second story on David, which didn't appear until 1972, and it wasn't really me interviewing him while he was here in the D.C. area. I wanted that to be more of a friendly thing. I had no idea what was going to happen on this 3 weeks in the United States. And my brother would fill me in. We talked on the phone almost every day. So in the movie Stardust, they have David doing an unpaid gig for a bunch of vacuum cleaner salesmen. And that's supposed to be funny, and I guess it was a little humorous in the movie, but it never happened. David didn't come with equipment. He didn't come with a band. He knew that he was not, and they make a big deal of this in the movie. Oh, he was shocked that he arrived in America and he couldn't perform. He was a gentleman. It was interesting because he ended up back at my house in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And one of the bands I was managing at the time, because besides being a writer, I was managing artists, was called Sky Cobb. Their drummer's name was Marcus Cuff. Marcus is now the premier tattoo photographer and motorcycle photographer in Los Angeles. And when he left Sky Cobb, he was the drummer in Emmy Lou Harris's Angel Band. And so Bowie comes back to my place, and there's Sky Cobb's in the living room, and they've got a bong and they're passing it around, and David does not partake. And they ignored David. It was like, who is this freak? You know, and that really pissed me off. And to this day, for Marcus, every time I talk to him in LA, I bring it up. He could kick himself for not really having befriended David Bowie on that first day in the States. So there was nothing, you know, it was almost like, it wasn't like I was walking into a dressing room to interview Jim Morrison. David Bowie was all of a sudden had become a member of the Overman family. And that's really what it felt like. And I get a lot of mail now, email from Bowie fans who know the story of his first day in the United States and have seen the photo. That photo of me, my brother, and David on my parents' living room couch started appearing in British publications 15 years ago.
I mean, that picture is just fantastic. I mean, it just looks so, it's so surreal. It's like David Bowie at Ozzy and Harriet's house or something. It's the coolest photo.
Yeah, you know, for years, I would get messages from people saying, that must be a joint in his hand in the photo. And it's not. It's my father's business card. David was interested in my father's work managing a brewery, which played a part in my life, too. My fourth grade show and tell in the 1950s, my father brought home hops, barley, all the ingredients to make beer, and that was my show and tell, how to make beer in my fourth grade class. So
that's one way to get popular in school.
I think I was a little ahead of my time with home brewing.
Right. Yeah. Wow. One of my favorite parts of the story of David visiting your house is kind of giving him the tour, and you showed him your 1955 Dodgers versus Yankees World Series ticket, which is cool on its own, but autographed by Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart.
Right.
That still blows my mind. How did you get that?
Okay. My father, as manager, a manager of National Bohemian Beer, in 55, he was the branch manager of the year. So the brewery gave us the use of the company plane and tickets to three World Series games, New York Yankees versus the Brooklyn Dodgers, the classic World Series of all time. And sitting in front of us, we had box seats between home plate and third base. Directly in front of us was Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. And of course, I was 8 years old. I didn't know from Humphrey Bogart. My mother says, oh my God, Michael. Yeah. Get their autographs. And I thought, well, who are they? So I went over, you know, cute little boy in his little shorts and all, and excuse me, could I get your autographs? And they obliged. So it's funny because the whole Lauren Bacall thing, and then David Bowie with the album cover with that Lauren Bacall look, you know,
hunky dory. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, there's a thread of DNA that just keeps popping up.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What kind of impact does Bowie have on your life now? Because you were saying you've had a busy few months with the 50th anniversary of his first America trip and the release of the Stardust movie, plus the release of your own book. Is he a big figure in your life still?
It's blowing my mind. That all of this Bowie stuff, when Main Man got in touch with me and wanted me to do one of their podcasts, and then the David Bowie fanatics in Great Britain heard I was going to do it, got in touch with me, said, "Don't do it." And I said, "Why?" "Oh, David hated Tony DeVries at the end. You know, there was a very acrimonious breakup." And I thought, well, you know, when I did my due diligence and saw that Tony DeVries was taking 50% of what David made, I thought that was akin to Colonel Parker and Elvis, because that was the same arrangement. But Tony DeVries really, really launched David's career. But unfortunately, David had a drug problem, and it got very bad, and Tony had a zero tolerance for drugs. That was part of the breakup. So on David's part, it was his ripping me off. And on Tony's part, I can't deal with the drug thing. And Bowie fanatics are really fanatical. It's almost, once again, akin to Elvis Presley fans. He has such a great fan base.
You've said that you saw Bowie one more time years after he became your adopted English brother for that night in 1971. Tell me about the last time you saw him.
I had a 2-year consulting contract in LA that took me out there 1 week a month. So I ended up staying at the Hotel Nikko, which is a Japanese hotel. And one night at the Nikko, I'm at the bar, and David Bowie walks in with 9-inch nails. They had been in concert in LA that night. And on the other end of the bar is Soupy Sales. So I'm in the middle of the bar between 9-inch nails and Soupy Sales and David Bowie. So I'm in total heaven. You know, I go over and say hi to David, renew my acquaintance, and then leave him and him be. And I'm wondering what Soupy Sale is doing here. And this guy walks over and sits down next to me in a tuxedo. And he says, "Oh, that's David Bowie over there, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, that's David." I said, "That's Soupy Sale's there." And he says, "Yeah, I know that's Soupy. There's a roast here tonight for my uncle in the ballroom." I said, "Who's your uncle?" He says, "Milton Berle." So he brings Milton Berle out of the roast to the bar. So I'm at the bar with David Bowie, Nine Inch Nails, Soupy Sales, and Milton Berle. Well,
this sounds like the setup to a joke.
Yeah, I know. And when that evening ended, I had watched, because I was staying at the Mika 1 week a month for 2 years. And I had watched these people come in and put two $100 bills on the bar and get a tiny snifter out of a glass, out of a bottle that was in a lock cabinet. And after this Nine Inch Nails, David Bowie thing, the bartender says, "Wow, let me buy you a drink. What would you like?" And I said, "I'll have what's in that lock cabinet."
Did he do it?
Yeah, he did. It was like 300-year-old brandy. It was like tasting silk in your mouth. It was pretty incredible.
What did David say when he saw you? That must have been a shock for him.
Well, he didn't realize who I was at first. This would have been in the mid-1990s, so it had been 24 years, and how many people has David met? But as soon as I said Oberman, "Oh, my God, how are you? You know, how's your brother? And, you know, he had just come off playing that night, and, I said, everything's fine. I said, my parents are still alive, and they certainly remember you well. Give them my regards and say hello to Ron for me." And that was it.
Wow, what an incredible coda to your Bowie experience. What's next for you with your book coming out? Is there a sequel, or what are you working on?
My book is sitting with HBO right now, and with the head of production for HBO, I don't know what's going to come of that. I don't know how they could, you know, they'd have to make a long series out of it. It's been an interesting trip. And to think, look, when I was 25 years old, I didn't think I'd live to see 50. When I was 50, I got out of the music business and became a wildlife photographer. So I left the wildlife for wildlife. And I never thought that at age 70, 71, I would be doing this book. It's been incredible. I thought that being out with great blue herons and bald eagles and all would put an end to my music business stuff. But this has been a really good trip for me writing this book. It got a lot out.
Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.